my dad, let my ashes float down the green river.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. You're listening to a cover of the John Prine song Paradise, which was released by Roger Waters. Today, for most of the hour, we'll look back at the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster that happened 10 years ago, and we look forward to how to avoid similar catastrophes in the future. We're going to hear from three members of Congress, from a former Deepwater Horizon worker, and from several environmental advocacy groups. Later in the show, I'll take your phone calls. The number is 813-239-9663. The email is dj@wmnf.org. Text 813-433-0885. Before we focus on the 10-year anniversary of the BP disaster, though, I'd like to look at the growing concern around one aspect of the coronavirus pandemic: its devastating effect on long-term care facilities like nursing homes and assisted living facilities. On Friday, the New York Times reported there have been 6,900 coronavirus deaths in nursing homes across the country. A New York State report found that 19 of that state's nursing homes have had at least 20 deaths linked to the pandemic. There were news reports about homes so stricken by the virus that bodies had to be stacked inside storage rooms. Connecticut released a similar list, reporting that 8 nursing homes had at least 10 residents die. Meanwhile, in Pinellas County, a nursing home in Seminole has hospitalized at least 38 residents, and at least 3 of them have died. And the Miami Herald reports that Governor DeSantis's administration often has been unwilling or unable to provide crucial information about its coronavirus response, and at times has actively tried to shield critical details about the depths of the crisis from becoming public. It was only on Saturday that DeSantis cleared the way for Surgeon General Scott Rivkes to start allowing the names of nursing homes with positive coronavirus cases to be listed in the daily reports. The state released a list of 303 long-term care facilities with 1,694 reported cases of COVID-19. There have been 169 deaths. So I'd like to play a couple of Florida Public Radio stories on this topic. Florida's latest COVID-19 report shows elderly citizens make up 82% of the state's deaths from coronavirus. 20% of COVID-19 cases are found in long-term care facilities like nursing homes. Blaise Gainey reports advocates are calling for more information to be released.
Governor Ron DeSantis recently said the state would increase testing in long-term care facilities.
I am directing the Florida National Guard to create more strike teams to significantly ramp up testing in long-term care facilities. They have already visited and tested, I believe, hundreds of residents in South Florida with the National Guard strike teams. We are going to expand that to have 10 teams of 4, and we'll probably expand it beyond there as long as we have enough equipment and PPE.
But to Brian Lee, that's not good enough. He's the former ombudsman for the Department of Elder Affairs and now has the advocacy group Families for Better Care.
If you really want to get ahead of this virus, the best way to do it in these facilities is to test everyone. We already know that there are some providers who are doing that on their own, but find a way to get the test to these facilities to start testing the residents, start testing all the healthcare workers, because we know that, you know, people could be walking around, they're ticking time bombs with this virus, you know, they could be asymptomatic.
He says the state should be naming which facilities have recorded positive tests.
They keep arguing that there are HIPAA privacy laws that are in play here, and that by exposing this information would potentially reveal personal health information of residents. And I think that it's a misread of HIPAA. I think it's just being twisted.
DeSantis said most of the cases in nursing homes are amongst the staff, but the data given to the public doesn't show that. However, it does show that the virus kills nearly a tenth of every elderly person that catches it. Lee thinks because of how lethal it is, families should be notified as soon as an outbreak occurs so they can make sound decisions.
There's no requirement for facilities to contact families, let them know there's a COVID outbreak. And so Ohio took it upon themselves. They recognized that fact. And guess what their governor did? He made a requirement that through an executive order that there has to be a 24 hours has to be a notification to families if there's a COVID outbreak happening in a facility. Okay, so that helps.
The Florida Healthcare Association represents over 80% of the state's nursing homes. Communications Director Kristen Knapp says she's telling nursing homes to be transparent.
I did a webinar on Wednesday with about 500 providers where, you know, I encourage them, again, best practice, communicate with your family members at the local level. The conversation needs to happen between the facilities and the families and their appropriate stakeholders and their staff.
overall, there have been 1,454 positive cases from long-term care facilities. Where those cases are from is a mystery. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaze Ganey.
Statewide, more than 1,500 cases have been reported at nursing homes. Meanwhile, as the pandemic wears on, family members of nursing home residents worry about the impact of social isolation on their loved ones. Amy Green talked with Teresa Lombardi-Terrell, who has been using an iPad to talk with her 85-year-old father in a Central Florida nursing home.
We saw him on Easter Sunday, just through a window, because that's the closest we could get to him. But prior to that, it's been at least a month and a half.
And what's the hardest part about not seeing him?
Being able to hug him and touch him and just get close to him and reassure him that we're still here for him. I think he feels really alone, and definitely he feels isolated in there without human contact from his family.
How is your family maintaining contact with him, and what has been most helpful?
We took an old iPad and got it set up with basic apps on there for FaceTime. He has a telephone in his room with an address book of phone numbers, and he makes phone calls out to everybody in the family pretty much daily.
And how is he holding up with that?
He calls us all the time. He calls us around the clock. He calls us at 2 a.m. He's unaware of the time. He's not able to see the sun if it's up or down, you know, if it's nighttime or daytime. And so that's made it really hard for him, because he doesn't realize when he calls us at 2 that it's 2 a.m. and not 2 p.m. in the afternoon.
What information has the nursing home been sharing with you about whether anyone there is tested positive, whether they have enough face masks, and how the staff is protecting residents?
From what I understand, they take the temperatures of the staff coming in and out of the facility, but they have not told us yet that there has been cases of COVID in their facility. I'm not sure that they actually would tell us, because I think that would put the family into a bit of a panic, which has been concerning, because that's what we do ask when we call to check in on him. Has anybody tested positive for it? And they just tell us no.
What else do you think would help him? What else would put your mind at ease?
I think it would be very helpful if they would have a place for us to go up and talk to him. I mean, even when you go to visit a prisoner at a facility, they actually have a window and a telephone. And I think something like that, just to establish some type of face-to-face communication with a phone, because he can't hear us shouting through the glass window. There's probably a lot of families in the same situation. And if this pandemic lasts any longer, I think there's going to be a lot of need for interaction with their loved ones in the nursing homes. I think it helps them find a way to strive and thrive a little bit better. I think there's going to be a lot of depression, because you have spouses that have their other spouse in the facility and they can't get close to them. And that's what my mom is, and I'm seeing her pain through this whole thing.
I've been speaking with Teresa Lombardi-Terrell, a Central Florida resident whose father is in a nursing home.
What are your experiences with having loved ones in long-term care facilities during the coronavirus Safer at Home directives? And what do you think the state should do? Later on in the show, we'll open up phones for you to call 813-239-9663 and share your story. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. You can also email me at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. We turn now to our main topic for the rest of the hour. 10 years ago today, an explosion aboard BP's Deepwater Horizon rig killed 11 workers and set off an unprecedented oil blowout a mile below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico. For 87 days, more than 200 million gallons of oil spewed into the Gulf. Much of it remains and can still be found in Gulf animals. In a moment, you'll hear Tampa area Congressmember Kathy Castor call it the worst environmental disaster in the history of the U.S. She participated in one of two conference calls about the anniversary and about what can be done to prevent future disasters. They were hosted by environmental groups that are pushing to permanently close the eastern Gulf of Mexico to drilling. A moratorium expires in 2022. The U.S. House has passed a permanent ban on drilling in the eastern Gulf, but the Senate has not acted. California member of Congress Alan Lowenthal is a member of the House of Natural Resources Committee. He slammed the Trump administration's rollback of safety and environmental regulations in one call organized by the environmental law group Earth Justice.
Thank you all for joining us today. in remembering the BP Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. This tragedy spilled hundreds of millions of gallons of oil onto the Gulf, killing trillions of fish, a million birds, and sadly, took the lives of 11 members of the crew. The environmental impacts are still being felt a decade later. While serious steps were taken at the time by the federal government to ensure that such a tragedy never reoccurred, the Trump administration has spent more than 3 years aggressively pushing to erase the painful lessons learned from Deepwater. They've begun to roll back not just important post-Deepwater safeguards, such as the well control rule, but also critical environmental protections put in place by earlier Republican and Democratic administrations. They have reinterpreted the century-old Migratory Bird Protection Act, ensuring that its critical protections will no longer be enforced by this Department of Interior. If a deep water-type disaster happened today, not a single penny in fines under the act would result. This is unconscionable. They've tried to dramatically expand offshore oil drilling outside of the Gulf into the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Arctic. And despite their current pause in pushing for expanded offshore drilling, no one is under any illusion that a second-term Trump administration would not aggressively renew their push for offshore oil expansion along our coasts. This administration has learned nothing from Deepwater and remains determined to pursue a disastrous drill everywhere at all costs agenda that threatens our public health, our environment, and our climate. I will continue to fight against any administration that places short-term industry profits over the health of our people and the health of our planet. We cannot allow our nation to move backward on these hard-won environmental protections. While we are here today to remember, let us not forget that we're also here to recommit ourselves to this fight.
Orlando area member of Congress Darren Soto is also on the House Natural Resources Committee.
First, I want to thank Chairman Lowenthal for his amazing leadership on the Energy and Resources Committee in Natural Resources. He's been a champion of the Gulf Coast, the East Coast, the West Coast, all of America's coasts, and we appreciate that very much in Florida. It's hard to believe it's been nearly 10 years since our West Coast of Florida was devastated by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. I was in the state legislature at the time and was horrified by weeks at a time of oil spilling through and reaching Florida's beaches, and the untold devastation to marine life, as well as Florida's businesses. When you think of the beaches there, like Siesta Key and Clearwater and DeSoto Beach, some of the best beaches in the world, those are America's beaches. Those are for every American to enjoy, and to see issues happen were just more than disheartening. We saw over 200 million gallons of oil from the Gulf of Mexico explode out of the oil rig. It was the worst offshore oil disaster in U.S. history. And we still must remember the 11 Americans that were killed there. As we look to the long-term effects, for 5 years after, more than 75% of all dolphin pregnancies failed in the oiled areas. Up to 170,000 sea turtles were killed by the spill, and 800,000 birds. Certain populations of fish, shrimp, and squid decreased by as much as 85%. That's a critical loss for the ecosystem there and for Florida's fisheries and for families who count on that as a source of protein. Fisheries were closed. The demand for Gulf seafood plummeted, costing us over $1 billion in the seafood industry. And the recreation industry lost more than $500 million. The spill impacted beach, fishing, and boating activities. Just to give you an idea, 90% of the businesses in the Gulf area lost all their business within days. Preventing this offshore oil drilling is an endless fight with these moratoriums that come and could potentially go. Our states and our country's resources are too precious to be put at risk. They're key to our environmental and economic future. And this isn't just a Florida thing. Democrats and Republicans agree on this, many of us together. In September, the House passed two bipartisan bills banning new offshore oil drilling and gas drilling off the Atlantic Pacific Coast and the Florida Gulf Coast. These are important steps in the right direction. One of these bills would permanently extend the existing moratorium on drilling off the Florida Gulf Coast, set to expire in 2022. And that was co-introduced by my dear friend, Congressman Rooney, a Republican from the Gulf Coast area of Southwest Florida. And we need to continue to fight for this. But the Senate needs to act. What are they waiting for? We've heard our Florida U.S. senators say positive things, but then not do anything. We need the Senate to act on this so that we don't have another BP oil spill. And to make matters worse, the Trump administration is trying to ease safety regulations and ease an ability to be able to do offshore drilling with their national drilling plan, and then easing safety regulations put in place after Deep Horizon spill, calling them unnecessary regulatory burdens, like making sure that well pressure is balanced and safe, making sure we have independent inspections. These aren't unnecessary regulatory burdens. These are the lessons we learn from history so that we don't repeat the same disasters that have happened before. Further, the administration continues to try to reopen these waters again. It's pretty clear. And I want to say just on a personal note, I've had many members, even of the Natural Resources Committee on the other side of the aisle, talk about bringing their families to the Gulf Coast, bringing them to the Panhandle and other areas, while they try to, in the public, attack these moratoriums. This is where they're bringing their families. So we need to all get real here. We need to understand these are America's beaches. These are America's marine life and oceans and seas. And at a time when oil is at an all-time low in price, and we already are the biggest exporter in the world right now, why in the world would we want to expand drilling to precious environmental areas and start expensive offshore drilling? It doesn't make environmental sense. It doesn't make economic sense. It just plain doesn't make any sense.
You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. You can email me at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Soto mentioned Republican Congressmember Francis Rooney from the Fort Myers and Naples area. On another call sponsored by the environmental group Oceana, Rooney's legislative director said Rooney has looked at the science and the economy and the future of the oil industry and came to the conclusion that offshore drilling should not be expanded. Rooney is a co-sponsor of a bill to introduce a tax on carbon. He also called attention to a Bahamian drilling operation 40 miles off Florida's east coast. On that same call was Tampa area Member of Congress, Democrat Kathy Castor.
It's great to see my friend Robin Miller from Bay Beach's chamber on here because we were working hand in hand back 10 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been 10 years. It's still fresh in my mind, and I know it's still fresh in the minds of folks who live along the Gulf Coast because even with COVID right now, this reminds me of how we felt at that time because overnight, you had the blowout, 11 workers lost their lives, but all of the sudden people had lost their jobs. Small business owners all across the Gulf Coast lost business, had to furlough workers. It was the worst catastrophe, environmental catastrophe in American history. And it was devastating, and we are still recovering from the impacts. But as we know from the scientists who keep reporting, there is still environmental damage in the Gulf of Mexico that we are going to be dealing with for decades to come. I'm a native Floridian as well, and I love, this is what makes Florida special. And clean water is tied directly to a healthy economy and a healthy environment here. This is what it's all about. So the BP blowout was our worst nightmare come true. We had warned for years and years, keep those risky oil rigs off of our beaches. We haven't industrialized our coastline. Our economy relies on the clean water. And remember, we were in the midst of kind of the drill baby drill era when this happened. So I've seen an enormous change in public opinion, but it's unfortunate it took that kind of catastrophe to open people's lives. It has not changed the interests of the oil and gas companies. They have been wholly irresponsible. And I know there is it's very attractive to say, oh, well, they've learned a lesson too. Oh, they have, they're more responsible now. I haven't seen it whatsoever. In the wake of the blowout, there was a national commission established by the Obama administration. It was bipartisan. It was partly led by former Florida governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham. And they had a whole host of recommendations. Part of it was to enhance safety measures for those offshore rigs. A part of it was to strengthen agency oversight. A lot of recommendations on additional research for the Gulf to make sure that we understand the long-term impacts. The Congress did pass the Restore Act in 2012, 2 years later, and that provided some monies for long-term research, and we've stood up a good Center for Excellence here in Florida. That's important. It established some new monitoring protocols and ocean observing systems in the Gulf, but we were so far behind. The Restore Act was important. But what needed to come alongside of it were those safety measures for rigs, the blowout preventers, all of the protocols. And the oil and gas industry and their allies in the U.S. Congress have fought this every step of the way. The Obama administration instituted them, but because that was done by regulation, not by law, by legislation passed in the Congress, it hasn't taken effect. And in fact, in the subsequent years, oil and gas industry and their allies in the Congress have rolled back additional protections. So we're less prepared now as oil and gas industry has sought to bring the rigs closer to our shores. And they have had an unfortunate friend in the White House in the Trump administration to encourage that happening. Can you believe that they didn't learn a lesson about the economic damage and environmental damage that offshore drilling poses to our way of life here? But there is some good news too. And I want to thank my colleague, Congressman Francis Rooney, the Republican from the Naples area. He has been a champion. And with Congressman Rudy's leadership, we were able to galvanize the bipartisan Florida congressional delegation to help lead the way to adopt a permanent ban on oil drilling off of the Gulf Coast beaches. So the House of Representatives has acted. We were calling on the U.S. Senate to do the same. I think this is going to be an important election issue because people understand that our way of life is at risk. And if we're going to focus on how we build a stronger economy, coming out of COVID, coming out of the BP catastrophe, it's got to be one built on clean energy. We know how to do this. We can be smarter. And in Florida, we know when a hurricane comes through and devastates a community, tears or wrecks your home, you build it back on a stronger foundation. And we are going to have to be smarter with taxpayer dollars, smarter on policy decisions to protect our way of life, to make sure that families stay healthy and well. That's what it's all about.
You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. You can email me at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Many of the regulations put on oil drilling after the BP disaster have been rescinded. This is Christian Wagley with the group Healthy Gulf.
We're a nonprofit organization working to protect the Gulf of Mexico and the waterways and communities along its shores. And just wanted to make a few quick points. You know, first of all, Healthy Gulf works a lot on the oversight of the oil and gas industry, which even includes flying out and monitoring existing rigs in the Gulf. And I can tell you that 10 years after the BP disaster, offshore drilling is as dirty and dangerous as ever. Oil companies are pushing the limits of technology. They're going farther and deeper to get to remaining deposits of oil and gas. And they're doing that in a deregulated environment in which important protections put into place because of the BP disaster have been eliminated. When the BP blowout occurred, that well was operating in just over 4,900 feet of water. There are currently 13 rigs operating in the Gulf in deeper waters, with the deepest at almost 9,600 feet and as far as 200 miles offshore. That's a long way from help if there's trouble. Visits to rigs by federal inspectors and enforcement actions against drilling operations have declined in recent years, and important post-BP safety rules regulating well production and the use of blowout preventers have been weakened. So 10 years after BP, the drilling operations are deeper and riskier, and there's less federal oversight to keep them safe. That's a combination that puts Florida's beaches at risk for another BP-type disaster. Now, I also wanted to mention that while fighting against expanded drilling, Florida's also rapidly embracing clean energy after years of lagging behind. The state's now second in the nation behind California for solar jobs and fifth in the amount of installed solar capacity. I used to be able to joke that New Jersey had more installed solar capacity than Florida, but we've rapidly caught up and passed them now, which is great. So, you know, we have a couple of local solar companies here that I work with a lot in the Pensacola area. Their business is booming. You probably have them in your community as well, wherever you live in Florida. That transition to renewables can ultimately help eliminate offshore drilling altogether. And so it's one of the most hopeful trends for a cleaner and healthier future for Florida, and we need to strongly push that transition. Finally, I wanted to speak about our coalition. I don't think you will find a broader or stronger coalition anywhere than the one aligned against offshore drilling off the Florida coast. It's coastal businesses, it's tourism councils, hoteliers, environmentalists, fishermen, boaters, military leaders. They've all taken a strong stand against drilling. We have a quality of life and an economy in Florida that's based on healthy natural resources, namely clean water and white sand. And offshore drilling is totally incompatible with that. Now, despite that fact, the current Trump administration plan that's still on the table calls for opening the Eastern Gulf to drilling after the current moratorium expires in 2022. Our elected officials have heard the people of Florida, as Representative Castor mentioned. She and Representative Rooney were part of a bipartisan effort that saw the House pass a permanent moratorium on Eastern Gulf drilling last fall. Now we just need the Senate to follow suit.
The president of the Tampa Bay Beaches Chamber of Commerce, Robin Miller, pointed out the economic damage of offshore oil drilling on businesses and residents of the Gulf Coast.
I've been in this position at the chamber for 12 years. I'm representing over 700 plus businesses along just the Gulf Coast of Pinellas County. And I will remember the first week of my job in 2008, we started our advocacy against offshore drilling in our little tiny organization, at that time, 200 businesses. And the unfortunate incident that happened with Deepwater Horizon, it definitely escalated our advocacy mission. And unfortunately, in the light of what happened, we can't ever forget that. We can't forget. And I would concur, Representative, that in some capacity, in every day waking up in the last couple of weeks and driving the beaches and speaking with businesses, there is a relative nature to it. Our businesses are tourism. Our organization's 80% tourism-based businesses, and their livelihood, fishermen and hotels and restaurants, they depend on the beautiful aspect of our Gulf beaches and the waterways. So, you know, as an organization that is always fighting for the right of tourism in any capacity, this is always the highest priority in our list of advocacy issues in the federal and the state. I have a great government affairs director, Doug Izzo, and he and I will never let this fight rest. And unfortunately, it's a sad case that we have to fight it, and that there are people that do not understand the importance of turning to alternative sources of energy and really take this off the table once and for all, and let's really move forward Florida forward and make a strong stance as it relates to offshore drilling.
You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. You can email me at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. Dr. Sarah Giltz is a marine scientist with Oceana.
Oceana is the largest international ocean conservation organization in the world. I'm here today to present on our new report, a look back at what has been learned in the 10 years since the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster. We took a deep dive into the scientific literature and government reports. We spoke to researchers in the Gulf and interviewed people from Louisiana to Florida who were impacted by the disaster. The Deepwater Horizon caused catastrophic impacts to the environment and coastal economy. These are lessons we cannot afford to ignore. I'll provide a brief summary of our report as well as Oceana's recommendations. The Deepwater Horizon destroyed habitats and killed animals across the Gulf of Mexico. 1,300 miles of shoreline were oiled from Texas to Florida. In addition to the huge number of dead animals you see here, oil hit some species particularly hard. For bottlenose dolphins, oil caused liver damage, tooth loss, and lung problems. For 5 years, more than 75% of the dolphin pregnancies failed in the oiled area. The Gulf of Mexico Brutus whale population decreased by about 22% following the disaster. These are among the most endangered whales in the world, and oil industry activities remain a primary threat to their precarious survival. The economic impacts were devastating and widespread. Fishing was shut down, and many people were scared to eat Gulf seafood. The seafood industry lost nearly $1 billion. Over 10 million user days of beach, fishing, and boating activity were lost, which cost the recreation industry over $500 million. Today, offshore drilling remains dirty and dangerous. The industry's record is unacceptable, and there are too many spills, too many injuries, and too many offshore worker deaths. Offshore drilling also brings infrastructure to the coast, and each additional pipeline or refinery brings risks of accidents and spills. The infrastructure footprint of the oil industry in the Gulf of Mexico is massive. As of 2016, there were over 2,000 offshore platforms and more than 26,000 miles of pipeline. That's more than enough to circle the Earth. President Trump has proposed a massive expansion of drilling to more than 90% of all federal waters throughout the Atlantic, Pacific, and Arctic oceans, as well as off Florida's Gulf Coast. At stake are thriving fishing and tourism businesses, healthy marine ecosystems, and a coastal way of life. And we've learned that where they drill, they spill. Oceana recommends that President Trump halt all efforts to expand offshore drilling to new areas and reverse efforts to weaken offshore safety. Congress should protect the coast from expanded offshore drilling and incentivize investments in clean renewable energy. And you can find our full report along with videos from the interviews we did and interactive website at oceana.org/hindsight2020.
Besides the environmental and economic toll of the BP disaster, there was a major human cost. 11 workers died 10 years ago. Leo Linder is a retired rig worker on the Deepwater Horizon.
I was a mud engineer on the Horizon. I was on it that night. And I wish I could spend my time unpacking my heart and telling you about these 11 men. But even now, 10 years later, the grief fills me up. It's just too fresh. I think it just overwhelmed me. But what I can say is that what happened on the Horizon didn't start on the rig. It started in corporate boardrooms. It ended on the rig. It started from an overriding priority to make as much profit as possible. This is not a priority unique to BP, but in the case of the Horizon, it proved to be fatal. It's a pretty general problem. As a matter of fact, 10 years ago this month, the same drive for profit resulted in the Upper Big Branch mine explosion that killed 29 miners in West Virginia. There is this general push for deregulation. And this is also a push for profit. It undercuts safety, though. The new well control rule they were talking about that's been promulgated in the Gulf by Bessie talks about creating savings for oil producers and creating additional capital investment, increasing production. I mean, it reads like an investment banker wrote it and not a regulator. And in the 10 years since the Horizon, we can see the same things happening in a number of other industries, in the collapse of the Hard Rock Cafe, and a petrochemical industry that creates the highest rate of cancer in the U.S. in the parishes we call Cancer Alley. And nationally, in a pharmaceutical industry that hawked opioids to the American public like they were conducting a new opium war against us. In a recent study in a medical journal called The Lancet, it found that nearly 70,000 lives would be saved every year by taking the profit motive out of health insurance. 70,000 people a year. I mean, if 11 people are worthy of remembrance and memorial, and they really are most worthy, what are 70,000 worth? I hope that people can begin to realize that these accidents and tragedies aren't just fate or the result of occasional negligence, but they happen because of the relentless drive to make profit. And the way we handle our economy, profit seems to be our only policy. I hope, if not today, then someday, that ordinary Americans will look to themselves and start to judge whether or not this is really what they value also.
In the Gulf of Mexico, you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:41 in the afternoon, and we're going to take your calls for the rest of the hour. Here's the number to call in, 813-239-9663, as we look back at the BP oil disaster, which was 10 years ago. Here are some questions that you can answer if you'd like. Have we learned any lessons from that disaster and in the aftermath? And what are your memories of the Deepwater Horizon disaster? Again, the number to call, 813-239-9663. We have a text from Ron in West Tampa who writes, I think the oil companies have basically gotten away with a major crime in their being unaccountable with what happened after the Deepwater Horizon tragedy. And Trump and company are making future accidents even more likely by destroying any and all regulations that threaten oil company profits. So Ron writes that. And do you disagree with Ron or do you agree with him? Give us a call, 813-239-9663. And I have a couple more sound bites I can play because I was asking the participants about dispersants. That's a big question that comes up anytime we talk about the oil disaster. Should there be limitations on the use of dispersants on oil spills in the future, was my question to them. And this is the response from Dr. Sarah Giltz, who is a marine scientist with Oceana.
First, I'd say that the best thing we could do would be to prevent another disaster like the Deepwater Horizon, so we never have to even consider using dispersants. We know that dispersants are toxic, that in some cases, when you mix dispersants with oil, that's more toxic to animals than oil by itself. We've also seen that the unprecedented amount of dispersants that were used during the Deepwater Horizon, particularly those in the deep sea use, may not have been as effective as was hoped. And so in some cases, this dispersant use could have made things worse.
Well, that was Dr. Sarah Giltz, a marine scientist with Oceana. Here's what Julie Hauserman with Earth Justice said. She said that nobody knows what chemicals were in the dispersant that was used during the BP oil disaster.
I'd also like to add that Earth Justice had to, you know, sue to even find out what was in Corexit, which, you know, if you're going to have massive spraying over a public water body, that's completely ridiculous.
And I should tell people that there is a severe thunderstorm watch issued for the Tampa Bay area until 3 this afternoon. Some parts of the area, including South Pinellas and South Hillsborough, are under a severe thunderstorm warning. And here's what meteorologist Jeff Huffman says about this strong line of storms.
Some of the stronger storms could produce damaging wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour or some small hail. I also can't rule out a tornado, although that risk is quite low at this time.
There have been some tornadoes in North Florida and Northeast Central Florida. Huffman says the front and the storm activity will exit Florida later tonight, which will be followed by slightly cooler and drier air mass tomorrow. Well, again, we're going to talk about the BP oil disaster this hour, and we hope that you will call in. 813-239-9663 is the number to call. What do you think about whether we've learned lessons, and what are your memories of the BP oil disaster? Also, I'd like to ask, what do you think, who do you agree with, the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate? The House has passed a ban on drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, but the Senate has not responded yet, hasn't passed anything. I'm just wondering what our Senator Rubio and Scott, our Senators Rubio and Scott, are they asking their colleagues enough to deal with this moratorium that's ending in 2022? What are your thoughts? 813-239-9663. 9663. And you can also comment on what we talked about at the top of the show, which was nursing homes in Florida and across the country and how they're being especially hard hit by the coronavirus. And I just want to remind people that according to the Florida Department of Health website, which was updated this morning, there are now more than 26,600 positive coronavirus cases in the state. 789 people have died in Florida, and more than 3,800 people are hospitalized. That's a number that continues to grow. There are almost certainly more cases than this in the state, but because not everyone has been tested in Florida. And where are you, and what's the coronavirus situation like where you are? One of the most interesting things about this is the county in our region that has the most deaths based on coronavirus is Manatee County, which now has 31 deaths. The next highest is Pinellas with 19. Sarasota with 24, and Pinellas with 19 are the next two highest counties. So one of the counties that does not have the most population, Manatee County, is the one that's leading in deaths. Well, we'd like to go to Jackie right now on the air. Jackie, hi. What would you like to say?
Hi. Thank you for the show. Thank you for this forum. I would just like to let you know that there's still oil from the Deep Horizon spill washing up on the beaches in Clearwater. And the way I know this is when my children and I first moved here 7 years ago, we were walking on the beach and our feet were squeaking. And I was like, what's this black stuff? Oh my gosh, that must be oil. Well, it still washes up. And if we get strong currents and storms like moved in here last week, there's a ton of oil that washes up onto the beaches still to this day.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that they're saying about the where did the oil go is a lot of it just settled down into the ocean floor. And, you know, some of it's in the really deep part of the ocean right underneath the well, but a lot of it is on the continental shelf and on the continental slope. And you're right, once that gets stirred up, it's going to come up on the beaches. So I really appreciate you letting us know that you see it. And it's sad. It's a sad story, but I appreciate you telling us that you see it in Clearwater.
Yes, and we're really going to have our work cut out for us after this administration to put back all the protections and to try to catch up and help our environment after this disaster of policy storm that we are undergoing. Just a horrible blow to our planet, and we've all got to do our part to make up for this mess.
All right, thanks so much for calling in, Jackie. We appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I want to remind people that you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. It's 12:48 in the afternoon, and you can email me at dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885, or if you'd like to call in and join this conversation about your memories of the BP oil disaster, 813-239-9663. And Jackie, you could call the Coast Guard if you see oil on the beaches. And we have a text message from the 727 area code, which isn't signed, but it says, regarding dispersants, does it make anything better or worse by keeping most of the oil and dispersants off the surface deep in the water column? Which is worse, deep oil or floating oil? And I don't have any experts on to ask that, but what we've learned through our reporting over the last decade is that, you know, once if the oil's on the surface, it can evaporate, or it can get burned off, or it can get corralled by these booms. But once it gets into the water column or into the ocean floor, it's really hard to clean up. So that's something to pay attention to about, you know, whether you think it would be worse to have it in the water column or on the surface. So thank you for that text from the 727 area code. And we'd like to go now to, before I go to Stanley, I want to give out the number, 813-239-9663, if you'd like to join this conversation. But let's go now to Stanley. Hi, Stanley.
Yes, hi, this is Stanley, and I'm a lifelong resident of Florida, and Tampa specifically. I recall at the time of the oil spill, I was doing a lot of international travel. And I often would fly from TIA to Dallas to catch my international flight. And I remember on two occasions, the American Airlines pilot would point out the oil sheen from the spill as we kind of cut across the Gulf of Mexico. And it was so heartbreaking to see this long, miles-long string of oil. And I don't believe that neither Scott or Rubio will truly stand up for Florida, nor especially given Scott's relationship with POTUS and his backers. And it's just devastating, as is, you know, what's been going on with our springs and so forth. I would say that all of us here in Florida, whether natural-born Floridians or whether those that have just moved here, it's a shame they cannot be educated on the quality of life that we had locally prior to our springs being decimated from too much water being taken from them. Here in Hillsborough County, along so many of the lakes were spring-fed, and as a child, it was almost going up the Ishnatuckney. You could jump in so many of these lakes and ponds, and there was boiling, boils from the underground springs that fed them. And I just find it atrocious of what not only the Trump administration is doing, but Scott, we know his puppet, and he does not, he doesn't care for our environment. He can hop in his private plane and fly to, other parts of the world that still do have healthy beaches. And one last thing, I don't know if you've read, not only the coral bleaching that's going on in our reefs, especially, in the Everglades and off the coast of East Florida, but now there's something that they say, they don't know what exactly is causing it, but they can visit a reef site, and within a week, a reef has gone from healthy and vibrant to absolutely wiped out. And there's just a small team of researchers working on this, mainly due to budget cuts, federal and state under the Scott administration. So please listen to those lawmakers who are passionate about our environment and vote for them.
All right, Stanley, thank you for that call, and thank you for pointing that out. And if you want to learn more about the it's called coral tissue loss disease. I've talked to some researchers who are working on that, and you can find those stories on our website. I would just search for coral, and you'll find some of the stories, some of the interviews I've done with the researchers who are studying that coral disease. But I appreciate you for bringing it up. Thanks so much for calling in, Stanley.
Yeah, great job. Thank you.
All right, thanks very much. And you're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and on WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:54 in the afternoon, and we're talking about the 10-year anniversary of the BP oil disaster. What are your thoughts? What do you think we've learned as lessons? You can email me at dj@WMNF.org or text 813-433-0885. I want to read a couple of text messages that have come in, but I'd also like to take your call at 813-239-9663. So this is a text that comes in from area code 813, unsigned. It says, the use of dispersants is to keep oil off the surface, and it lowers the public impact. It's like not wanting us to see the coffins coming back from wars. So that's the opinion here of 813. And, I think that's, I don't know if that's the reason necessarily they do it, but that is one unintended or intended, impact of that, is that you don't see the oil when it's down on the surface of on the floor of the ocean, whereas you would on the slick, as our previous caller Stanley was saying, you can see it as you fly over. All right, well, here we have another 813 unsigned text message here. It says, our Republican housemaid continues to sweep dirt under the rug. Can't say exactly, I know specifically what that's referring to, but that's what the text message comes in from the area code 813. So if you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call in is 813-239-9663. Do you think that the Senate should follow the House's lead and pass a permanent ban on drilling in the eastern Gulf of Mexico? Eastern Gulf would include water offshore of Florida, the Gulf Coast of Florida. The House did pass that, but the current moratorium ends in 2022, and unless the Senate follows suit, and then I guess unless the President signs it or that his veto is overridden, that moratorium will expire in a couple of years. And we heard from three members of Congress this hour who are in the House, and we heard from the Chief of Staff of a Republican who supports it as well, but we haven't heard from any senators who say why they oppose it or why it won't come up for a vote. All right, you're listening to WMNF Tampa. Let's go now to Daryl. Hi, Daryl.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Just a point. We have Florida statutes that I haven't really heard anybody bring up, and it's Title 28, Natural Resources Conservation, Reclamation, and Use, Chapter 377, Energy Resources. And it goes into a whole series of things under 377.24, Notice of Intention to Drill Well Permits, Abandoned Wells, and Dry Holes. And it gets a whole lot of no permits under all these conditions, but I'm not sure exactly where they're proposing to do this drilling, but it says, without exception, after July 1st, 1989, no permit to drill a well in search of oil or gas shall be granted south of 26 degree north latitude off Florida's west coast and south of 27 degree north latitude on the east coast. And then it goes on a little further, and they go on to say that, western boundary of the state of Florida bordering Alabama is set forth, and it goes on and on. But I think you'll find that very interesting, especially the section number 9, which explains all the latitudes and so on of where they're not supposed to be drilling. And I've heard nobody talk about the law.
I don't have access to the law you're referring to, but my assumption is that when you're talking about Florida law, is that would apply to Florida waters, which is something I think like 9 miles offshore. Correct me if I'm wrong. There's federal water.
Yeah, I know there is a differences there, and that's where I'm not sure where they're, you know, where this is defined as far as what they're proposing to do. But oftentimes I find that a lot of times people seem to forget the laws that we have here to try to protect things. And we've got a lot of things, even with the where they're drilling in the Everglades and so on, that seem to me to be contradictions of what our statutes are here, because there's, like I say, there's 9 subsets here, and they're clearly defined, each one of these things. So it might be something for people to look at, especially some of our politicians.
Yes, so we have... There is drilling or exploring for drilling in the Everglades and Big Cypress, and there's also explorations up in northwest Florida, as our reporters have reported on, and others around the state. So good point about that. And just so you know, most of the Congress people were talking about in federal waters, which is further offshore, there's probably never going to be drilling in Florida waters right along the coast within the first couple of miles. That's true. So thank you
And you also discussed Corexit, and I know that was when that all happened. That was banned in Europe, and they brought it over here, and although the EPA tested it, they didn't test it under real-world conditions. And so it was false. When they kind of okayed it, it was really false because it was not under how they were actually going to apply it. So that was kind of a lie.
All right, great. Thanks for the call. Right,
thank you,
Daryl. And Nikki writes, yes, by all means, this needs to be renewed. We don't need the oil from the oceans. It's crazy to be drilling in the oceans anywhere. The fish, plant, and animal kills are not worth it. Thank you, Sean. Your shows are always great. Well, thanks for that compliment, Nikki. And I want to thank everyone who wrote in and called in. And I'm sorry, Jackie, I'm not going to be able to get to your call. I apologize. But if you'd like to leave a voicemail with your thoughts, 813-238-8001, extension 115. And if you missed any of this show, you can listen to it on our website, wmnf.org/news. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, or Twitter at WMNF News. And thanks to engineers Rob Lori, DT, and Miss Julie, I'm Sean Canaan. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR News headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.